The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Do not go out after dark. That is when the beast will hunt.
Gregor says there was something lurking in the darkness tonight. Something that was hunting.
Shh.
What?
Listen.
Congratulations, Miss Creed.
What do you want from me?
Right this way, my dear.
Anya, help me, please!
If I die inside there, Bob goes free.
Of course.
I want that sword.
The sword stays with me. That's my final offer.
Here's my counteroffer. The sword, Anya. Now.
Rogue Angel number 12, The Soul Stealer, from Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Jackknife by William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Michael Replogle, David Coyne, Karen Carbone, Lily Beacon, Elliot Dash, Eric Messner, Colleen Delaney, Elizabeth Demery, Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Dolores King-Williams, Nanette Savard, and Bobby Aselford.
Muhammad Rasulullah, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, La ilaha.
In Washington today, the mood is tense as hostile rhetoric flies between Tel Aviv and Tehran over the Iranian government's continued refusal to suspend its nuclear program. Israeli officials say they'll take whatever action is necessary to defend the country in the face of intelligence indicating Iran intends to launch a nuclear strike at Jerusalem. Tehran accuses the Israelis of paranoia, warmongering, and threatening the tenuous stability of the Middle East. Iran insists its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. French, German, and Russian officials are calling on the United Nations to step in and restrain Israel from taking any aggressive actions. The White House says the president is also urging Israel's prime minister to use restraint. A White House spokesperson quoted the president as saying, "War is not the answer. It has never been the answer, and it never will be."
Hamed al-Bashar felt his chest swell with pride as the bent, robed, and hooded figure of Sheikh Abu ibn Kahir shuffled along the line of freedom fighters, pausing to speak quiet words of encouragement to each of them. the Sheikh traveled to this remote hill village from the south of France, where he lived. That alone was enough to tell Hamed the importance of the mission he and his companions were about to undertake. The Sheikh was the leader of Hizb-ut-Tahrir, a shadowy but growing sect within the Islamic fundamentalist movement. The group forged ties with other Islamic organizations throughout the world, but most people considered it a minor player in the ongoing war to cleanse infidels from the face of the earth and restore Islam to its rightful place of dominance over creation. No one would see it that way after Hamed and his comrades concluded their mission, whatever it might be. Then everyone would know the power of Hizb-ut-Tahrir and its devotion to the glories of Allah. Sheikh Ibn Kahir paused in front of Hamed.
You are willing to die for your faith?
Sheikh, I am eager to die for my faith.
And what gifts will you bring to the infidels?
A sword, fire, and death.
A faint smile touched the Sheikh's seamed leathery face as he nodded in approval at the answer. Hamed was speaking somewhat metaphorically, of course, and he knew it. A sword would do little good against the hated Americans. There were too many of them. The promise of a sword was only symbolic. But fire and death, ah, those were real, as the Americans would someday know well. Someday soon, Hamed hoped.
Where are you from?
The Sheikh's question caught Hamed by surprise.
Paris.
His parents immigrated to France from Algeria before Hamed was born, and though raised there, he never felt French. His true nation was Islam, no other.
I thought I recognized the accent. I live in France.
Hamed didn't know what to say. The Sheikh's expression was hard to read. Hamed felt the old feelings of inferiority welling up inside him. It bothered him he was not from Saudi Arabia or Syria or even Egypt.
What is your name?
Hamed al-Bashar.
The Sheikh half turned and pointed a bony finger at one of the villagers, a stocky middle-aged man, a minor official. One of the party assembled to meet Sheikh Ibn Kahir and escort him here to this mud-walled compound on the edge of the settlement where training took place.
Do you see that man?
I see him.
He is a traitor. The American CIA pays him to betray us.
The villager's eyes widened in surprise and horror. He began to shake his head. Whether in denial of the accusation or shock at being found out, Hamed could not know. It didn't matter. The Sheikh said it. It must be so. One of the Sheikh's bony hands came out from under the robes, holding a jambiya knife.
Deal with the traitor, Hamed al-Bashar.
As the Sheikh spoke, he held out the knife. Hamed took the knife and walked toward the accused villager, who began to back away in terror. The man's nerve broke, and he turned to run. The elder had no chance against the younger, faster, stronger Hamed, who caught him from behind after only a few steps and looped an arm around his neck. Hamed jerked back on the man's head, exposing his throat. The knife flashed in the sunlight as it bit into the tight-drawn flesh. Hamed drew the blade across the man's throat in one deep, strong slash. A crimson fountain of blood spurted into the air and splashed across the sand. The man's body spasmed in Hamed's tight grip. Severing the spine posed some difficulties, but the rest of it was easy. Within a few moments, the headless body toppled onto the sand and continued to pump blood from the grisly hole where the traitor's head once was. Hamed held the head up by the hair as the Sheikh nodded approvingly. The men of the village voiced their approval. Hamed's heart pounded with fierce joy at knowing he carried out Allah's will and eliminated a tool of the infidels. How much more joyful would it be when he performed his holy mission and entered paradise knowing he helped kill not a single traitor, but thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of those minions of Satan, those hated Americans, delivering unto them their punishment for supporting the Israelis. Oh, happy day that would be, Hamed thought, as he looked at the contorted face of the blood-dripping head he dangled from his hand.
After months of intense behind-the-scenes negotiations, an agreement in principle between Israel and Iran on Tehran's nuclear program has collapsed. Brokered by representatives of the United States, the agreement would have opened Iranian nuclear facilities to United Nations inspectors in an effort to bolster Iranian claims that they're not manufacturing weapons of mass destruction. The recent rise to power by more fundamentalist politicians in Iran evidently fueled the collapse of the talks, although a spokesman for the Iranian government insists there was never any such agreement. In Washington, the president issued a statement calling the stalemate a temporary setback and said she's confident a peaceful solution to the crisis can be found.
Those fucking camel jockeys never had any intention of holding up their part of the bargain.
Don't let the press hear you using an ethnic slur like that. After all, you represent the party of tolerance and diversity.
The president fixed her husband with the familiar steely-eyed glare. After 30 years of marriage, it wasn't as effective on him as it once was. At first, she scared him shitless with it. In those moments, he saw her true self. Over the years, though, he realized maintaining the facade of a happy marriage was too important to her plans for her to ever direct the full force of her rage at him. All he need do was exercise a little restraint and discretion. She skated by on the edge of enough scandals, both personal and political. She couldn't afford to let any sort of accident befall him, as happened to others who got in her way. Besides, he truly loved her, despite knowing he was at most a useful prop. So when they were alone like this, in the upstairs quarters of the White House, he made it a habit to speak as plainly with her as he could. He wanted to help.
You're right. They were lying to you from the get-go, just stringing you along with empty promises so you'd keep the Israelis off their backs for a while longer.
Yes, but I believed them at first. I mean, why wouldn't I? They had no reason to fear UN inspections. Pulling the wool over the eyes of the United Nations is no great trick. Even a cheap thug like Saddam Hussein was able to do it for years. They never did figure out what he was up to.
Don't let anybody hear you say that, either. Everybody knows Bush lied and Saddam never had any weapons of mass destruction. You don't want to go letting people think that conventional wisdom might not be true.
All they had to do was hide the real stuff and put on a dog and pony show for the inspectors. Then we would have had a good excuse for going along with whatever the UN said, and without our backing, the Israelis would have had to accept it too.
Maybe you don't know the Israelis quite as well as you think you do.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that when those folks feel like they've been backed into a corner, they're liable to do almost anything.
They won't attack Iran. My God, they're already surrounded by enemies who want them dead as it is.
Then they don't have a hell of a lot to lose now, do they?
That shook her for a second. He could tell by the way she looked. She truly believed every setback was temporary. In the end, everything would work out the way she wanted it to because she was smarter than everybody else. Smarter and more decent and moral. And anyone who disagreed with her was evil or stupid or both, and therefore deserved to lose. Maybe she was right. He hoped she was, but he feared the rest of the world might not cooperate. She resumed pacing back and forth across the luxuriously appointed bedroom.
Why now? Everything was looking good. All the Iranians had to do was play along for a while. The whole situation would have cooled down so that next year would be nice and peaceful leading up to the election. Why throw a wrench in the works right now?
Maybe they were just stalling for time. Maybe they don't need to anymore.
She stopped and swung around toward him.
You mean you think they're ready to do something?
I don't know. But I got a feeling there's a shitstorm coming, and we won't be able to deny our way out of this one.
Hamed al-Bashar finished entering the data into the file and saved it, then clicked on the next item in the list and opened a new window to enter more information. The office around him was quiet on a Sunday afternoon. He was the only one in today. Everyone else was home watching football on television. Not Hamed, though. For one thing, he hated American football, just as he hated everything else about America. But football held a special place in his hatred, ever since he saw news footage on French television of Arab mobs celebrating the deaths of thousands of infidels on 9/11. One image from that glorious day remained seared in his brain. An Arab man was laughing and dancing for joy in the street in Baghdad or Damascus or some other city. Hamed didn't remember exactly where. It didn't matter. Perched on the man's shoulders was his son, a boy of 7 or 8 years old. Unbelievably, the boy wore a Dallas Cowboys sweatshirt. The satanic influence of the Americans wormed its insidious way so far into the Arab world that a child could wear a symbol of the infidel's national sport and not think anything of it. At that moment, Hamed knew peace was not possible, that Islam could never coexist with such evil. The only way to truly save the world was to cleanse it of all Western influences. Europe was no threat to that glorious goal. The French? He knew enough of the French to know they would never successfully resist anything for very long, not without someone else coming to their rescue. The Germans were not much better. The Spaniards and Italians weren't worth thinking about. The British, though, might pose a bit of a problem, but they were already showing numerous signs of giving up. And nowhere in sub-equatorial Africa or South America was there enough cohesion to represent a threat to the march of Islam. As for China and Russia, well, oil and oil money could always buy them off. Anyway, they would be happy to be rid of America. So America and its godless infidel football had to go. There was another reason Hamed was working on a Sunday afternoon. He was a go-getter, so said his supervisor. His instructions were simple. Blend in and wait for the summons calling him to perform the work of Allah. When, and the details of the mission, Hamed did not know. But he, as the other members of his group, was patient. Whether it took months or years, he would be here in Kansas City, Missouri, working in the transportation division of one of America's largest corporations, helping to coordinate the movement of goods throughout the nation by truck. His passport, work visa, and all his other papers were the finest money could buy. The paper trail, a mixture of fact and fiction, stretched back years and showed him emigrating from France to Quebec, where, according to documents in his possession, he lived and worked for 5 years before applying for permission to enter the United States. His record was clean and beyond reproach. Of course, he didn't enter the United States by legal means, as all his phony paperwork indicated. He came across the border from Canada at a remote location, along with several others from his cell. The rest of the group smuggled across the southern border from Mexico. Homeland Security. What a joke. And the American so-called crackdown on illegal immigration was equally amusing. None of the American politicians, especially those currently in power, really wanted to stop the free flow of illegals from Mexico. Doing so might cost them Hispanic votes. As for the Canadian border, that was too long and porous to pretend enforcement was possible. What sort of country was it, Hamed often wondered, that not only allows its deadliest enemies to enter, but practically invites them in? His answer was, a country of fools. No wonder the United States would soon be nothing but a bad memory.
Why, Hamed, honey, what the hell are you doing here on Sunday?
The voice took him by surprise and brought him out of a pleasant vision of America in flaming ruins. He turned and saw Mandy Armitage standing by the office door. She wore shorts and a shirt with no sleeves and a pair of those rubber sandals Americans called flip-flops. Her blonde hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Hamed secretly burned with shame at the sight of so much female flesh and an uncovered female head, but he forced himself to smile back at her.
I just thought I'd get a head start on those beers of lading for tomorrow morning's shipments.
Honey, you're just a working fool.
Mandy was one of his supervisors, and Hamed burned with shame because of that as well. In an Islamic America, females would have no such positions.
What are you doing here?
He knew he must make small talk with her so she wouldn't be suspicious of him. Americans chattered incessantly.
Would you believe it? We're going to Arrowhead to watch the Chiefs play the Colts this afternoon, and I went off and left the tickets in my desk.
She went across the big room to her cubicle, smaller than some but larger than most, to retrieve the tickets. With tickets in hand, she walked to the door and gave him another smile.
Don't work too hard now, here.
Don't worry about that.
She paused in the doorway.
Say, maybe you'd like to go to a game sometime. We can always get tickets through the company, even when the stadium's sold out.
She was looking at him with lust in her eyes again, he thought. He knew he was not unattractive to American women, with his olive skin, his thick dark hair, his neatly trimmed mustache and beard. He was in superb physical shape. With the least bit of encouragement on his part, Mandy Armitage would lie with him. And she wasn't the only one. That was out of the question, of course. Even considering such a thing was sinful. But Hamed managed not to show the revulsion he felt.
Oh, sorry, I don't know anything about American football. I wouldn't have the slightest idea what was going on.
Oh, that's right. Where you come from, people play soccer, don't they? That's what you call football.
That's what 90% of the world calls football, you stupid American cow, Hamed thought.
I could explain the rules to you. I've got 4 brothers who played varsity, and I was head cheerleader. I'd have you knowing the difference between a blitz and a post pattern in no time.
I'll think about it.
Ahmed had no intention of wasting even a second's thought on such worthless drivel.
All right, honey. See you tomorrow.
Ahmed smiled and waved as Mehdi went out, then turned back to his computer.
And I'll see you in hell, you foolish infidel bitch.
McCabe first saw the woman as he rolled the big rig into the truck stop parking lot. She was a lot lizard. A hooker, of course. The tight cut-off blue jean shorts, the equally tight tank top, and the high heels told him that much. Now he stood over her three large, unwelcome, semi-conscious customers. McCabe was breathing a little hard. He turned to see the woman, Lindy, cowering against the rig.
Hey, you all right?
How did you... There were three of them!
Lindy's eyes were wide with amazement. Several men approached from the direction of the truck stop. They were all drivers, and McCabe recognized a couple of them. One of the men looked around at the three bodies sprawled on the parking lot. He grinned at McCabe.
Should have known you'd be mixed up in this trouble, Jackknife.
No, it was their idea. I tried to get them to back down, but they were stubborn about it.
Damn fools, if you ask me.
McCabe turned to Lindy.
Why don't you call it a night and go home?
She still looked a little dazed by McCabe's martial display. After a moment, Lindy nodded.
Yeah, I might just do that.
Before you go, though, get out the money they paid you.
That brought her back to Earth.
You mean I really have to give it back to them?
Well, it seems like it would be the fair thing to do, considering...
You know what those bastards wanted to do to me?
Nope, and I don't want to know. Just get the money out they paid you.
Of all the stupid fucking ideas. Shit.
She dug several wadded-up bills from her purse and tried to give them to McCabe. He pointed to the driver who had greeted him earlier.
Give it to Roy here. He's honest. And he'll see to it the money gets back to its rightful owners.
Grudgingly, Lindy handed the bills to the driver called Roy.
Now what?
Now you go home. Don't be around when these fellas recover from our little dance. And I go get some coffee, something to eat, and some sleep for what's left of the night.
Lindy watched him go.
I don't get it. He was worried about me being here when those guys wake up, but he's staying.
That's because he knows how to take care of himself. Those dumb bastards picked the wrong guy to tangle with.
He's just a truck driver, isn't he?
Just a truck driver? Honey, that's Jackknife McCabe, ex-Special Forces. He was in Desert Storm, then went back to Iraq years later after stopovers in Afghanistan, Pakistan, probably half a dozen of those other Istan places that used to be part of Russia. Lord knows where all he's been and what he's done, because he won't talk much about it. But I'll tell you this much. Those fellas who were hassling you, they're lucky to be alive right now. I reckon a lot of bad guys who've run up against old Jackknife ain't anymore.
Sources in Washington and Tel Aviv confirm Israel launched an airstrike against the Iranian nuclear facility in Bushehr before dawn this morning. The Israeli military says the target was completely destroyed, but a spokesman for the Iranian government issued a statement claiming damage was minor and the only casualties were innocent civilian workers. The facility was long rumored to be an important part of Iran's nuclear weapons program. Speaking on condition of anonymity, an Israeli intelligence officer claimed the action set Iran's nuclear program back 5 years. Iranian officials called the attack an act of wanton, lawless aggression against a peaceful nation. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the United Nations convened the Security Council and promised a full investigation of the incident. White House Secretary Davison says the president is on top of the situation and will issue a statement as soon as she has all the facts concerning the incident. She considers this situation to be very grave, he said, and promises the response of the United States will be measured and appropriate.
The president's index finger stabbed angrily at the remote control as she switched through the channels on the TV monitor set up in the Oval Office. The story was the same on every network.
Aggression by the Israelis.
Unconscionable arrogance.
Unprovoked act of war.
Well, almost every network.
Now, if I'm being honest, that was the worst, most pathetic rendition of any song I've ever heard. You're an absolutely terrible singer. Just appallingly bad.
One by one, the president looked at the advisors gathered around her. During her campaign, she promised a rainbow administration. She followed through on the promise. The vice president was young, handsome, and black. The secretary of state was Hispanic. The national security advisor was a striking Chinese-American woman, rumored to be bisexual. The secretary of defense was female, too, a former general in the Air Force. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was the only white male in the room, other than the president's husband, who sat quietly in a corner, if the Oval Office could really be said to have corners. Despite the carefully calculated diversity of the group, at this moment, in this emergency meeting in the White House, they held two things in common. They were scared, and they didn't know what to do.
Well, what's our response to this going to be?
How bad is it really? In military terms, that is.
The president looked at the Secretary of Defense.
The Israelis blew the crap out of the place, leveled it. It was a good, clean strike, too, with little or no collateral damage, despite what the Iranians are saying. Our satellite imagery confirmed all of that.
What about civilian casualties?
I'm sure any workers inside the plant at that hour were civilians. But they were civilians who knew damn good and well that they were working on nuclear weapons intended to one day blow Israel off the face of the earth. I wouldn't call that innocent.
What about the civilian workers at our nuclear facilities? Wouldn't you consider them innocent?
Of course I would.
The president folded her arms across her chest.
Well, the Iranians feel the same way about their people.
She prided herself on being able to empathize with other points of view, especially those of America's enemies.
I don't see any way we can support Israel on this.
The national security advisor turned uneasily in her chair.
What about 60 years of friendship between the United States and Israel? Doesn't that count for anything?
The president frowned. She wasn't sure she liked or trusted the NSA. The woman was brilliant, with all the proper academic credentials, as well as mixed ethnicity, debatable sexuality, and camera-friendly looks. She was freaking perfect, as the president's husband once put it. Except for the fact, the president came to realize, she didn't fully share the administration's views. Neither did SecDef, but being a good soldier, she would go along with whatever her commander-in-chief said.
Israel is still our friend, but that doesn't mean we have to be 100% in favor of anything Israel happens to do.
Respond however you want, of course, but if you condemn Israel's action, it'll be a slap in the face. The Israelis won't forget it, and it'll make you look like you're waffling and soft on the threat of Islamofascism.
We don't use that word in this White House.
Why not? It's a perfectly good descriptive word. Or did you mean the word waffling?
The president glanced around to see her husband with his hand over his face. He was trying to look solemn, but she could tell the big bastard was actually stifling a chuckle. He loved seeing someone get the better of her, even for a moment, probably because he couldn't.
All I've tried to do is repair some of the damage the previous administration did to this country's standing in the community of nations.
Oh, sure, that's what the rest of the world says they want from the United States. They want us to make nice and consult them on any action before we ever make a move and do whatever they tell us. But when we behave like that, they don't see a strong, cooperative nation. They see a patsy, a pushover. They see an impotent giant without the balls to do what needs to be done. I'm sorry if that's not politically correct enough for you, Madam President, but you hired me to tell the truth as I see it. And that's the way I see it.
For a long moment, the president thought about firing the arrogant bitch on the spot. Nobody talked to her like that and got away with it. Nobody. Even her husband would be licking his wounds, literally as well as figuratively in his case, if he ever dared speak to her in that tone of voice. But the slant-eyed slut had a point, the pragmatic part of the president's brain insisted. Ever since the bloody debacle in Iraq, caused by the total troop pullout as soon as she took office, America's enemies around the world were licking their chops, just waiting for the right opportunity to humble the giant more. According to intelligence briefings from the CIA and Homeland Security, it was only a matter of time. A matter of when, not if. But maybe she could postpone the day when some other rogue nation or organization would spit in Uncle Sam's face. Maybe a show of strength now was needed. For one thing, it would take the rest of the world by surprise. It was good to keep your enemies off balance, a little unsure of what to expect. The atmosphere in the Oval Office following the NSA's comments was thick with tension. The president broke it by turning to the Secretary of State.
What's the diplomatic response by the Iranians going to be?
Can they do anything except whine to the UN and get the French and the Germans and the Russians to feel sorry for them?
What else can they do?
The president looked at the SecDef and the JCS chairman in turn.
Militarily?
They don't have the capacity to do much of anything. The Israelis wiped out any shot of delivering a nuclear strike. While their conventional forces are fairly strong, they're not up to invading Israel.
But all they can do is turn off the oil spigot.
Shut down the Strait of Hormuz, you mean?
That they can do with their navy and air force, if nobody's there to stop them.
What are our assets in the area?
A few.
The chairman was an old navy man, an admiral. His eyes glittered with the desire to get into the action.
And we can get our carriers in the Mediterranean over there in 48 hours.
The president looked at the vice president, but the gesture was more out of courtesy than anything else. They both knew who was going to make the decision here. But he was strong-willed enough to register an opinion anyway.
I don't see that you have any real choice, ma'am.
The president wanted to look at her husband and see if she could tell what he thought, but she suppressed the impulse. He wasn't the commander-in-chief here. She was. As she looked at the chairman, her head jerked in an abrupt nod.
Get those carriers to the Gulf, Admiral.
She could tell he fought to keep from grinning as he snapped to attention.
Will do, ma'am.
All right, everybody out.
She stalked over behind the desk, her desk, the president's desk, the ultimate seat of power, and what was still the most powerful nation in the world.
I've got a statement to write. Somebody tell my chief of staff to advise the networks I'll address the nation at 8 tonight.
She sat down and pulled a legal pad and a pen over to her as they all filed out of the Oval Office, even her husband. He lingered until last and then looked at her with his bushy eyebrows lifted questioningly, as if he were unsure whether she really wanted him to go too or if she might want his help on her speech to the American people. She flipped an impatient hand at him, shooing him out with the others, and paid no attention to the hurt puppy dog look on his face. She had important work to do here. At the president's desk. Despite all the annoyances, God, the power felt good. As if she were born to it.
Accordingly, American aircraft carriers and other elements will be traveling to the Persian Gulf as quickly
Nate Sawyer
as possible
turned away from the TV.
Mom, where's the Persian Gulf?
Oh, I don't know. It's over in the Middle East somewhere.
Allison Sawyer was folding laundry on the small kitchen table in their little apartment and not paying much attention to the TV. She knew the president was on, talking about a crisis overseas. There was always a crisis somewhere overseas, it seemed like.
Where's the Middle East?
You know, Iraq and Iran and Israel, all those places. Don't they teach you this stuff in school?
I know all those countries you just said started with an I. Want to hear me say the alphabet?
You've been saying the alphabet since before you even started school.
I could read before I started school.
Allison wasn't so distracted by the laundry, she failed to hear the pride in her son's voice.
You sure could, champ.
And she could take some pride in that, too, since she was the one who read to him every day since he was a baby. She was convinced that was why he learned to read by the time he was 4, and now read at a higher level than any of the other kids in his 3rd grade class. She knew she wasn't supposed to make too much of a fuss. The teacher told her so. Acknowledging his hard work and ability might foster a sense of elitism in Nate, and ultimately damage the self-esteem of the other kids in the class. You couldn't have that. The whole public education system was geared toward leveling the playing field, making all the kids as much alike as possible. But facts were facts. Allison's kid was smart. She wanted to make sure he knew it, too. Maybe that way he wouldn't make the same sort of dumb mistakes his mom made, like marrying a self-centered asshole.
Are we gonna have a war?
What?
Allison set aside the laundry she was folding and walked into the living room. Maybe she ought to pay more attention to what the president was saying.
The president said there was gonna be a war between Israel and Iran. Are we gonna be in it?
Allison sat down on the edge of the sofa beside Nate.
Surely that's not what she said.
Uh-huh, just listen.
The camera, steady as a rock, showed the president sitting behind her desk in the Oval Office. She held some papers in front of her, but she wasn't reading from them. Instead, she gazed into the camera with an earnest, worried expression on her face.
Deeply regret that Israel was forced to take this action by Iran's continued refusal to allow United Nations inspectors in its nuclear facilities. I spoke to the Prime Minister of Israel a short time ago, and he personally assured me it was imperative action be taken now without delay. According to information received by the Israeli intelligence services, Iran was less than a week away from launching an armed nuclear missile at Tel Aviv.
See? A nuclear missile.
That doesn't mean there's going to be a war.
But if it was true, it meant Israel and Iran were damned close to a war. And it might happen yet if Iran tried any sort of payback for the Israeli air attack. Allison didn't keep up with politics much. Nate and her job kept her too busy for that. But there was such a bombardment of news and information all the time now, you couldn't help be aware of what was going on in this crazy world. Today especially, TV and radio were full of stuff about what was going on in the Middle East. As usual for that region, things seemed to be teetering on the brink of Armageddon.
Maybe you should go on to bed. You're already up past your bedtime.
No, I want to watch the rest of this.
You don't really care about somebody making a speech, even the president.
Well, there might be something good on afterwards.
Not likely, Allison thought. All the talking heads would yammer for another hour about everything the president said. Politicians and military experts from both parties would spout lockstep opposed opinions. The ones from the president's party would agree with everything she said. The ones from the opposition party would disagree. None of them would admit that if the situation were exactly the same, hell, if the words of the speech were exactly the same, and only the party affiliation reversed, their reactions would be exactly the opposite. That was what Allison hated about politics. That was why she didn't bother to vote anymore.
I don't think there's going to be anything else good on tonight. You go on to your room. I'll be in to read a story to you in a few minutes.
I can read it myself, you know.
I know you can.
She put an arm around his shoulders and hugged him to her.
But I still like to do it. Let me do it for a little while longer, okay?
Okay.
He trudged off toward his room. The apartment was small. He didn't have far to go. Allison leaned back against the sofa cushions and watched the last few minutes of the president's speech.
I can assure you, we will seek a solution respecting the rights of sovereign nations and abiding by the rule of law. We will not stand by allowing ourselves and the civilized world to descend once more into barbarism.
All that stuff meant the president didn't want to go to war. Everybody knew her anti-war credentials went way back. And everybody saw what happened in Iraq as soon as she took office. She cut and ran, choosing sure defeat over possible progress someday. Allison couldn't really fault her. The war was poorly run from what little Allison could see. That was just it, she thought as the president signed off.
Good night, and God bless the United States of America.
Allison shut off the TV before the talking heads got started. She, Allison Sawyer, was a civilian. All this stuff going on didn't have anything to do with her. She worried about her son and her job, and coming up with enough money to pay all the bills at the end of the month, with maybe a little left over for an occasional treat. Christmas was coming, after all. It was only a few days until Thanksgiving. Then it would be less than a month until Christmas, and Allison hadn't even started her shopping. Luckily, there was a new Megamart, one of those giant ultra-megamarts only a few miles away, on the interstate between Fort Worth and Denton. It was about to have its grand opening on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. There would be a lot of sales and specials. There always was on what was traditionally the biggest shopping day of the year, but the prices would be even better at the Ultra Mega Mart on that day. Allison started thinking about what she might be able to get Nate for Christmas. There would be a huge mob there, of course, but she might have to brave it anyway. She would do whatever was necessary to make this a good Christmas for her son. Although the Prophet taught his followers to practice moderation, Ahmed al-Bashar's reaction to what he was hearing and seeing on the television had no moderation to it. Indeed, he wished he were there in the Oval Office with a sword in his hand, the holy sword of Islam, so he could kill that Zionist bitch. Ahmed had little use for Iranians, of course. They were Shiites and he was Sunni, but right now his hatred for the Shiites was subordinated to his even greater hatred of the filthy Jews. At the training compound in the hills of Pakistan, his superiors in Hizb ut-Tahrir taught him that tribal differences must be put aside for now, because all of Islam faced an even greater threat. It was the goal of the West to wipe out the entire Muslim world, the leaders said, to obliterate all the Prophet's holy teachings. That was why the cause of jihad was so important. That was why the infidels must be wiped out first. The Jews' attack on Iran was just one more example of lawless aggression against the Muslim world. Now, instead of condemning it, the American president was supporting Israel. In fact, she was sending warships to the Persian Gulf to further suppress the Iranians and interfere with their right to enforce their will in their own waters. Ahmed was ready for action, ready for the call that would summon him to his mission, whatever it might be, ready to strike back against the great Satan, ready to die for his holy cause, eager to die, eager for the day when he would inflict the same pain and suffering on the Americans as they inflicted on his people, on his brothers, using the word loosely, in Iran, and in all the other places where Westerners attacked Muslims. Eager as well, though just a minor consideration, for the beautiful virgins awaiting him in paradise. What was important was striking back against the Jews and the Americans. The same thing, really. They were all Zionists. Filthy Zionists. The cheap cell phone Hamed bought in a drugstore in Crosby, North Dakota, not far from the Canadian border his first day in the United States, was finally ringing. Along with the phone, he had bought a time card, good for a year. He activated both the phone and the card from a computer in the public library, connected to the internet. He wrote the phone's number on a piece of paper, put it in a Get Well card, also bought at the drugstore, sealed the card in its envelope, addressed it to Bob Wilson at a post office box in St. Petersburg, Florida, bought a stamp from a coin-operated machine in the local post office, and dropped the card in the mail. Hamed fumbled the phone out of his shirt pocket and checked the little display window. Unknown caller, it read, just as it should. Hello?
Hey there, boy. It's your Uncle Billy down in Fort Worth. How y'all doing?
I'm sorry, you must have the wrong number. I had an Uncle Billy, but he passed away a few years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry to bother you, too. Y'all have a good evening now, here.
The call lasted seconds, but it accomplished its purpose. The coded exchange gave Hamed all the information he needed. Fort Worth. He would start tonight. His co-workers would wonder why he didn't show up at the office in the morning. He was an exemplary employee right from the start, but Hamed didn't care anymore. This was the summons he'd been waiting for ever since he came to this despotic nation. Those godless infidels at the Midwest Regional Transportation and Freight Division of Megamart Incorporated would just have to get along without Hamed al-Bashar from now on. Brad Parker crouched behind a large rock and peered down at the village, little more than a cluster of mud huts sprawled at the base of the hillside, except for the large, stone-walled compound at the edge of the settlement, the source of a rhythmic chug indicating the location of a generator. Parker's eyes, normally a light bluish-gray, darkened to the color of steel in moments of stress, tension, or anger. They were the same shade as a battleship now, as they narrowed in concentration, listening for the truck. Parker heard it, and if he could hear it, so could the guards inside the compound. They wouldn't think anything of it, he told himself. This was an agricultural area. The guards would think one of the local farmers was coming in early to get a jump on everybody else at the market. Parker's heart slugged hard in his chest. After all this time, all the covert actions, all the firefights, he still felt adrenaline coursing through him and was grateful for it. If he ever reached the point where his heart didn't beat fast before going into battle, it would be time to give up this job, go back to Langley, stand in a classroom, and teach other agents how to carry out ops like this. Yeah, like that was going to happen. Like he would ever live that long. The truck rounded a corner, picking up speed as it came into view, and headed straight toward the gates. The guards inside tumbled pretty quickly to what was going on. Floodlights mounted on the walls blazed into life, illuminating both the interior of the compound and the area outside the walls. Parker squinted against the glare. Bullets pinged off the front of the truck, where steel plates bolted to it served as primitive armor.
You ain't seen nothing yet, boys.
Parker tightened his grip on his rifle. The truck never slowed down, even though several bullets found the windshield and spiderwebbed the glass. That meant either the driver wasn't hit, or if he was, he was still able to keep his foot on the gas pedal. The truck hit the gates hard. Though Parker couldn't see what was going on from where he was, his planning with the tribal fighters was enough for him to know what was happening. Two men in the truck with grenade launchers were drawing beads on the building housing the generator, exposing themselves to the fire of the guards so they could get a clean shot. Parker heard both RPGs firing. The ground shook under his feet from the explosions. The floodlights went off as if someone tripped a switch. Parker knew that wasn't the case, though, because he could no longer hear the generator. The RPG guys blew it to hell.
Go, 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 go!
The tribal men dashed toward the gates in the sudden darkness. Another RPG launched.
At least one of the men with the grenade launchers lived long enough to get off a second shot. But no more explosions came as Parker and the men from the village darted through the wrecked gates and split up around the now-stopped truck. The compound's defenders couldn't see what they were shooting at, with the generator knocked out and the floodlights off. Parker wore night vision goggles pulled down over his eyes once the floodlights were out. That gave him an advantage. As he hurried past the stalled truck, Parker glanced into the cab and saw a motionless shape slumped over the steering wheel. The odds caught up to the driver. The same was true of the men with the grenade launchers. Both of them were sprawled on the ground, one on each side of the truck. They were riddled with bullets. They lived long enough to do their part in avenging the grisly death of their leader. Parker recalled how much easier his recruiting got the day the Hizbut Tahrir True Believer decapitated the village elder in front of his family and village. The generator building was a blazing ruin. Parker didn't look directly at it. The flames would have been blinding through the goggles. He spotted several men standing outside one of the other buildings, firing rifles and machine guns toward the place where the gates were. The terrorists knew that was where the follow-up attack would come. They were just a little too slow in concentrating their fire there. Parker snapped his own rifle to his shoulder and began squeezing off shots. The volley rolled out smoothly from the weapon. Every time it bucked against his shoulder, another of the compound's defenders folded up or went over backward as bullets tore through them. He killed five in a handful of seconds. Then, as bullets whistled past his ears and kicked up dust at his feet, he whirled away from the barrage and leapt behind the corner of the building. He reached under his cloak, found one of the grenades attached to his flak jacket, and leaned out from cover to fling it through an open doorway. Parker did his part, killing enough of the terrorists to even the odds between them and the local fighters. But he never sat on the sidelines, even for a moment. He ran toward the largest building, probably where the local leaders of Hizbut Tahrir lived, along with being the administrative center for the group. He swerved back and forth to throw off the aim of anyone trying to draw a bead. The battle was going on all over the compound now. The sounds were ugly, even to a man of Parker's experience. He tuned them out as he bounded onto a porch attached to the front of the largest building. The structure was made of wood instead of mud or stone, wide planks of raw lumber. Parker kicked the door open and went through with his rifle held ready to fire. He found himself in a long barracks-like room. Give these guys credit, Parker thought. They didn't live high on the hog like old Saddam did in Iraq. Their cause meant more to them than luxurious surroundings or personal possessions. Parker almost admired them for their courage and devotion to what they considered their duty. But for the fact that their duty included slaughtering thousands of innocent men, women, and children in the name of their God, they were death-loving lunatics. No amount of flowery rhetoric could cover that. From somewhere in the building, he heard a familiar sound, a shredder at work. With the compound under attack, some member or members of the group were trying to dispose of vital documents. Parker pinpointed the sound as best he could and ran to the end of the barracks room, where he found a narrow set of stairs. He went up the stairs as fast as he could. He knew whoever was up there could hear the clumping of boots on the steps, but it couldn't be helped. He paused before he reached the top of the staircase and searched under his cloak for another grenade. He ducked his head and covered his ears. The flashbang grenade went off with devastating effect, blinding and deafening anyone who wasn't ready for it. The eye-searing, ear-numbing blast lasted only a second, and Parker was moving again. He lunged up the rest of the stairs and came out in a room with several desks in it. Three terrorists were stumbling around, pawing at their eyes, obviously disoriented. Two carried rifles, and one had a pistol. The man with a pistol bumped into one of his fellow terrorists, turned, and started shooting, jerking the pistol's trigger in panic-stricken fashion. The unlucky bastard who bumped into him flew backward, half his head blown away by the bullets. Parker lifted his rifle. He sent a two-round tap going through the pistol wielder's skull and shot the third and final terrorist in the chest. Parker stepped over the bodies to get to the desks. He noticed that the sounds of battle outside in the compound had slowed down. He hoped his team had just about won. He started pawing through a heap of papers piled on the desk where the shredder was set up. It stood to reason the terrorists would start disposing of the most important papers first, but that wasn't a hard and fast rule. Who knew what might be scattered in this mess? He scanned the writing resembling chicken scratches, picking out familiar names and places. Islamic terrorism was like a spider web, with strands going every which way and connecting one group to all the others. He He was beginning to get the idea Hizbut Tahrir was at the center of that web, even more so than Al-Qaeda.
Holy shit.
He stiffened in shock as he stared at one document. It appeared to be notes of some sort, made during a meeting of the organization's top planners. The horrific plot shook even Parker, who thought he knew the depths to which these bloodthirsty madmen could sink. He was wrong. Worse yet, this plan appeared to be on the verge of launching a strike against the United States for its support of the Israeli air attack on Iran's nuclear bomb factory. Parker's eyesight blurred slightly. The night vision goggles made it hard to read. He ran a finger along a line of Arabic scrawls, seeing the characters that translated, at least loosely, into the term sleeper cell. Hizbut Tahrir agents were already inside the United States, waiting for orders. Al-Qaeda agents in the U.S. was old news in the intelligence community. Many of them were identified. The FBI and Homeland Security kept tabs on them as best they could without tipping off the agents their identities were known. But as far as Parker knew, admittedly, he could be behind the curve on this. The powers that be were unaware. Hizbut Tahrir agents were already in the country. This was important stuff, especially considering the crazy Sheikh's plan. Parker stuffed the handful of papers inside his jacket. He must pass them on to his superiors, no matter what else happened. Somebody had to warn the folks back home. The sudden burst of automatic weapons fire from below made him jerk his head up. Acting fast, Parker opened a window, scanned the area below, and started climbing out. He dropped a dozen feet or so to the ground, running as soon as his boots hit the sand. He left behind a lot of documents. They might be important in the ongoing battle against terrorism, but he had what he could grab, the notes detailing the latest, most heinous plot hatched by the bastards since 9/11. Bodies of the tribal fighters were sprawled everywhere, along with the dead homicidal maniacs in training. It looked to Parker as if the two sides pretty much wiped each other out. Unfortunately, a few of the terrorists survived. Now they spilled out of the building Parker just left, giving chase as he sprinted toward the gates. There were only four of them, he told himself. He could stop and fight. But with the information he was carrying, getting away was more important, even if it went against the grain. He darted around the truck used to crash through the gates. As he did, he was hit. The blow felt like a giant hand slapping him in the side. He spun out of control, hit the ground, rolled over a couple of times. As he came back up on his knees, he told himself to ignore the fiery pain in his side and squeezed the rifle's trigger. Set on full auto, it spewed death at the onrushing terrorists. Two of them were knocked backward. Another stumbled forward a few steps before falling on his face. The fourth spun in a curious dance before coming to rest against the truck. Parker struggled to his feet. His hand went to his side to check the wound. But surprisingly, there was no blood. He reached into his jacket and pulled out fragments of his radio. Well, he couldn't call any choppers in to extract him now, he thought. The radio saved his life, stopping the bullet. The impact was enough to knock him down and hurt like hell, but the slug didn't penetrate. It might have doomed him anyway, though, since he was a hell of a long way from anywhere, his only transportation his own 2 feet. At least, no one would be chasing him. As he looked around, he seemed to be the only person left alive in the compound on the edge of the village. The village inhabitants would be cowering in their beds, waiting to see if the shooting was going to start again. Maybe he could find another truck in running order, Parker thought, as he reloaded his rifle. Lord knows the one they used to bust in here was shot all to hell. He broke into a stumbling run that steadied somewhat as he loped off into the darkness. He hoped it wouldn't take him too long to contact his superiors. The intel he carried had to be passed on to the proper people ASAP. Parker hoped it wasn't already too late. He also hoped he could get clear of the compound before the C4 explosives the others were supposed to plant went off, if they'd been able to get the job done. He stumbled less than 50 meters when the explosions began behind him. The concussions knocked him to the ground. As he pressed his face to the sand, he thought it sounded as if the entire world were coming to an end.